All right, Zero Books viewers and listeners, I always start the same way nowadays, but welcome to Pop the Left. We're here with my usual co-host, Derek Varn. We were going to be talking about the history of the failures of social democratic movements this week, but reality caught up with us, and instead we will be discussing, riots and revolutions and insurrections and riots and strikes and bears.
Right.
Oh, my. So the dates that I put on the thumbnail, if I remember correctly, were 1848, 1968, 1965, and 1992 as the dates that we would kind of look at. And I'm going to turn to you, Derek, to start us out with 1848. And I guess maybe the question we should be considering, and what I want you to answer, is can riots lead to revolution? And when they do, how does that play out, and why does it happen?
So, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question in the context of 1848, because in some way, objectively, they did lead to revolution, but, and I'm going to say this is, but there's like a historical labeling problem that you have, because the distinction between a riot, a revolt, and an uprising is basically how you feel about it. And so when I went through, you know, the 1848 list of where there are various actions and started looking at them in specific, what we generally call riots are only in the places that failed. And so I'll talk about them last. That's London, Ireland, and Sweden. Mm-hmm. Those get labeled riots. And then there's a lot of uprisings that are basically riots that get organized as political factions come in. And in fact, Ireland actually is more like that. But since it failed, it's listed in the riot category sometimes, and sometimes it's called the March uprisings. One of the things that I noticed is there was a thesis by this communization guy, Joshua Clover, in this book, Riot, Threat, Riot, that he based off of the E.P. Thompson work of, you know, work in the history of this time period, mm-hmm. where he said that in the early period of labor movement, there was not any, the idea of a strike wasn't really coherent yet. There was no way to organize it. They didn't have unions. The unions that existed were illegal. They weren't really what we think of as unions. They were coming together at the same time. They really start coalescing around this time period. And so what you have is like riots turning into revolts, turning into occupations and armed seizures, and then those having political factions come in, kind of train them on the ground, and you have like basically low-key civil wars break out. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting, if you use France as the model, you see that you have significant riots in 1831 and in 1834, and then again in 1844. Those are also in Prague in 1844, and those are highly urban riot.
So I just want to break in and ask a question here, back mm-hmm. to Josh Clover. In the period that you're talking about, when there aren't strikes but only riots, to what degree does that have to do with the development of the working class as opposed to the illegality of unions? I mean, these are urban riots that you're talking about, mm-hmm. but are they around conditions that in the factory or in the workplace? Or are they in the marketplace? Do they have a class character?
They do have a class character, but it's confused because right now you have to deal with the distinction between proletarian worker and artisan. Mm-hmm. And that distinction is not necessarily all that clear yet. So one of the things that's leading to a lot of the urban riots is that the artisan guilds are completely disempowered by industrialization, and there's no other organizations replacing these guilds. And you have massive unemployment. And when I say massive unemployment, like one of the things I was doing for this and for when we were originally going to talk about the social democrats in the 20s and 30s, is you're looking at like two-thirds the available workforce being unemployed. So like higher than it's ever existed in the United States.
Right.
So you have massive, massive.
But those people who were unemployed were also probably relying to some degree on subsistence farming and other.
Well, yeah, they had to, like, there's no welfare state or anything like that. So in these countries, so what you're dealing with is you're dealing with artisans and former peasants who had gone into the cities and started working, and then there was massive layoffs or just decline in work. The biggest thing that really, there's three things that really spark thing off. We talked about it a little bit on our 1848 specific podcast, but this led to tons of riots. So you had like one of your first major financial panics in 1847. And this leads to a spike in urban unemployment. So something like 10,000 Viennese factory workers were unemployed overnight. A lot of that, so this is in Germany. So Germany actually, other than Sweden and England, experiences the most of these early riots. But what happens, it's very different there than Sweden and England, it's a contrast, is there are all these different movements, Republican movements, Democratic Republican movements, German unification movements, anarchist movements, the beginnings of the socialist movements, even though there was not a social democratic party in Germany yet. They all exist for these people to go into immediately. Mm-hmm. All right. So they filter into that. And then they start basically, you know, Engels ends up being a general and all this. Like, mm-hmm. They start basically militarizing very quickly. So those riots go into a military formation. So you have this huge financial crisis, mm-hmm. one of the biggest ones that hit the European continent. And when I say one of the first ones, there have been financial crises, obviously, in England before.
We got comments coming in, someone saying there's been financial crises before 1837.
Yeah, I mean, the business cycle existed in England all the way back, you know, probably to the 1600s. Mm-hmm. But the crises in the 1840s were also paired with famines that were directly related to monocropping for shipping. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in some ways, like right now, you had a whole bunch of different contingent factors kind of come together at once. You know, if you look at other financial crises that are important, you can look at, I think, probably like 1800, 1805. But this big mass one that we really see in 1847, 48 just totally throws everyone off guard. And we have no social safety net yet. Unions are barely a thing. You have guilds coming up, and they're being eradicated. Their historical trade secrets are, you know, their legal protections are undone by the end of feudalism. Mm-hmm. And so this just explodes into a bunch of different places. Do they become highly productive? Yeah, in places where there's organizations for them. However, we've already talked about what happens immediately in 1848. The different sides aren't actually all that unified in what they want, and they, you know, eventually kind of fall apart. They do break up one old order and blah, blah, blah.
You know, one thing that I think is worth noting, at least it seems to me that this is what is going on in our conversation here, is that when we talked about 1848 before, mm-hmm. we talked about it in terms of its political beginnings and the kinds of forms of government that were struggling with each other. And then to an extent, also based on the rising bourgeois class and the rise of capitalism as well on the economic right. side. But when we talk about riots, then suddenly you're starting in right away with unemployment numbers and day-to-day realities for working people. If you want to point to like maybe the beginning is of an immiseration thesis, you might point to 1847 maybe, and the recession there triggering those insurrections and riots, because that if you from a certain perspective, that is what sparked the revolutionary struggles, and not the political consciousness and the long-term kind of political history from the French Revolution onwards of in Europe. I guess the trick would be to take these two sides of the revolutionary struggle together.
Right. Well, and that's what happens, although even where it does happen, it fails. And when it fails for certain groups, it fails bad.
I don't mean take it together in struggle. I mean, just take it together as we analyze it, mm-hmm. Try to figure out where a continuation of an ideology and political perspective is having an influence on the reaction that working class people might have to a set of circumstances.
Well, one of the things when we talk about this time period, and we talked about it a little bit in our first thing, it is anachronistic to read a lot of these populations as highly proletarianized yet. Except for the urban populations where the artisans and peasants were forced out into the cities, you do not have anything like a mass scale proletariat outside of the urban areas, except maybe in England. And the end of the artisan guilds and all that in England had also led to, as is mentioned in the comments here today, stuff like the Luddite uprisings, and which were basically very targeted riots. They were aimed at production, industrial production machinery, and what a lot of what was going on in France in 1848 and actually before, as I mentioned, there have been riots in the 1830s too, was similar.
Okay, but just hold it for just a moment there, because you're saying, well, we shouldn't overestimate the size and the significance of the proletariat, we shouldn't think that Europe had been proletarianized yet. And yet, the violence that we could, is, I mean, I guess my question is it fair to say that these riots really did spark the 1848 revolutions?
I would say to some
degree, they did. It was a proletarian led. If they did, the whatever small elements of the proletariat there were that were developing,
they didn't lead it.
They didn't lead
it. They did not lead these revolutions. They did not.
They well, right, but they did. I mean, their actions preceded,
right,
the leadership.
I mean, this is one of the problems when you deal with classical socialist thing is the proletariat is supposed to lead itself, and it almost never actually does. And that is a problem. When you look at what happened in 1848, that's part of why things dissolve, is you have this mass movement of a bunch of different immiserated forces. And they're pulled into different directions. I mean, in some degree, even the bourgeoisie is immiserated in this time period. That's what the financial crisis really propels we're sick of this Ancien Régime shit, you know, and it leads to all kinds of problems, though, because in France and in Germany, you have places for these people to go. You kind of do in England, and this is what's fascinating. This is something to... Because the riots also occasionally signify the end of movements. So the big thing that people always wonder is, why didn't 1848 affect England very much? Mm-hmm. You have a developed proletariat. It's been there for a long time. It's been dealing with this for a lot longer. And you do have outbreaks. You have outbreaks in England, and you have outbreaks in Trafalgar Square. The Chartist movement, which was, the people that Marx got the name communist from, call a meeting, a peaceful meeting at Kennington Common on April 10th. And things seem to be going pretty well. And then they're marching, normal protest march, actually. Peaceful protest march, but they're marching to say, look, as most of these early marches were, they were just like peaceful demonstrations that you could field insurrectionary army kind of. And someone yells something, reactionary to the crowd. The police, they respond violently. The police come in. And there are riots in Trafalgar Square. They kick the police take the square. Then they get kicked out when the entire community comes back in later. But then they get crushed later on, and the Chartist movement pretty much dies with that riot. Like, if you go back and read all the postmortems, even some from, shortly thereafter, the riot seemed it's its last gasp. And the fact that the Chartists, which by and large actually weren't even the majority of the people in the riots, get blamed for it, seems to really quiet a lot of people down in England. The other thing is, there's this whole Catholic Protestant identity divide with the stopping solidarity with Ireland that comes into play. And so those two things together really seem to kind of shut it down. Now, what I've been trying to find out more about what happened in Sweden, because Sweden also it has 2 days of what, extreme riots. It's called the March on Rest. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that, they try to do what had happened in these other places where they start making political demands and start to militarize, but the militarization doesn't really happen. The military comes in and steps in this time, not the police, and 18 people are killed, and it dissolves in Sweden right there on the spot. Like, Sweden does not participate any further in the 1848. At least not in the mass scale.
And is it for similar reasons that that the leading social democratic movement got blamed for the riots?
No, I don't even think so. And I don't even think there was a social democratic movement. I mean, Sweden's barely not. I mean, Sweden's kind of a progressive feudal system. I mean, it's a weird thing at the time. I think actually they're just shocked about the military casualties, and it just. That kind of quells it immediately. So
Daniel saying, I just want to throw this, answer this and then move on. Daniels is questioning our whole framing of starting with 1848, saying we could go all the way back, I don't know how far back you want to go to find other riots.
Because riots prior to the development of the proletariat are peasants' revolts. And that's not really, I could talk about peasants' revolts all the way back to prehistory. What's the point?
Right. I mean, our premise is that the riots of today would have something in common with the riots of 1848 because we live in a capitalist. We live in a society, man. We live in a capitalist society.
So, I mean, like if you want to talk about riots being existent and all throughout as a transhistorical force, of course they have. People break shit when things go bad. Like, what you're trying to do is we're looking at a
situation. There were never any riots in Atlantis. So I just
but what I do think is more telling and more interesting to deal with is how these riots were the basis of signifying that there was some need for politicization. You mentioned 1832, the proletariat. They were only in one city, Daniel. They were in Lyon. That's it.
No, we should take questions later now. No more heckling and move on in our conversation. So I'm going to not look at the comments now. I'm going into private chat. Well, I'm not looking at the comments anymore.
So one of the things that you have to deal with when you talk about these early periods is properly speaking, wage earning proletariat as we think of it really had not existed as a mass form of employment in most of Europe proper until the very end of the 16th century going into the 17th century. So when the bourgeois revolutions happen is when that really begins. It is not there were other wage earners. There's been wage earners all the way back to antique societies, but it being the predominant form of social organization after the end of serfdom and when a lot of people are forced out of the peasantry in England due to enclosures and France due to famine and a lot of other stuff, that really begins. And with the French Revolution, I mean, but when you look at who's it's like the Sans Culottes, for example, it's hard to actually put one-on-one with the proletariat, like the way we think about it in Marxist terms, because it was like some of those people had never been wage earners. They were they were all kinds of dispossessed people. Mm-hmm. And so you have something like a proletariat beginning in that they are propertyless, but they do not necessarily have the means of their own production. And that also led to a lot of debates between the Proudhonists and the Blanquiists and all this about who should actually lead this stuff, because so many of the people in the sans-culottes were kind of petty proprietor-ish. Mm-hmm. But again, these classes, as we think about them in Marxist terms, are solidifying everywhere outside of England. They don't exist in mass, except maybe in the city-states of Italy. And even then, they don't have there's not a mass wage earning.
So I want to go back to this question. So you brought up two examples where riots didn't lead to insurrection and then or attempted revolution. And in those examples, there were particular reasons why there weren't generalizable reasons why it didn't
right.
lead to.
Right.
Well, I think but there was something else you said earlier, which was that these moments of riot can be the last gasp of a political movement or of an attempt at radical change,
right?
As well, and I guess that would be something you would have to judge in retrospect and not in the moment. Although maybe, I mean, it seems like you're saying two different things. If you say that they can sometimes be the last gasp of a political movement for radical change, rather than just simply a failed attempt at insurrection, but it seems to me that there's an implication there.
There's a steam and piston box metaphor, right? I make this metaphor a lot. It's a classic metaphor for this. It's not mm-hmm. one that I made up. But if the piston box is broken and the steam rises to it, mm-hmm. the piston box explodes. It doesn't pump anything. And that's the end of a movement. If it's there to pump that energy somewhere, that's the beginning of one. So you often see, if you look at the way revolutions happen, even 1917, we can pick any number of them. They can go in a lot of different directions. There are bread riots leading up to 1917. And
just using that piston box metaphor or analogy. So it seems like, are you saying that up until that moment when it exploded, there was steam making the piston move, and then
there's a piston box and there was steam and they were separate. Right. And if the piston box is broken and the steam hits it, that piston box doesn't work. It explodes. I mean, it's a metaphor to talk about how this happens, but mm. that's why you see these movements often begin and end in riots. It's not that the riots are usually even the most violent part of this stuff. I mean, if you look at the revolts in Germany, the violent part comes later, really. Mm-hmm. But and what they attempted to in Ireland gets very violent. It moves from riots into full-scale armed volleys with the military, with the British with British soldiers, and you know, it doesn't go so well. I mean, and furthermore, the other thing we have to think about, one of the things I was thinking about police putting it down versus other things, the societies that have police as we think of them, that's basically the settler colonial, the English-speaking settler colonial states. That's the United States and Canada, and they started off as slave retrieval units for
yes and no, but there were city watchmen and police in the urban areas first, or I mean, not like one led to the other, but they were, those two things rose separately, but around the same time. So the kind of police forces that would be putting down rioters in urban cities were not composed the kinds of police that would be going chasing
no.
after slaves that had
well
escaped.
There weren't riots in the United States in 1848, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I know,
when we've had riots at this time period, the military put them down, not the police.
Right. But my point is that the kind of rioting, kind of police that face off against rioters now can be traced back to the urban police.
Actually, the urban police really start with the occupation of Ireland. They don't actually start really on their own. So they're not, what I was about to get to is they're not even totally they come out of the slave units and all that. That's not even totally where they come from. The officers of the peace came when the military was actually too overextended in the empire to enforce rule in Ireland, and they started a police force. And
when would that have been?
Late 16th century.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about in the United States, like around right. the, you know, a little bit.
But you don't really have, like, you have, like, gendarmes and stuff like that, which are kind of police, which, but you don't really have police like we think about them outside of the English-speaking world, is what I'm saying, and like, a large...
You would go to watch the city limits and the streets, and usually you would fall asleep or get drunk, and they weren't paid, and...
You had the city watch, and you had peace officers, and they kind of get merged together. And actually, I've been trying to research how that happens, because it does happen throughout the English speaking world, mm-hmm. but it's not clear the moment to me that that does happen. And so you get a lot of very like, well, police force were, you know, were they originally come from slave posse. So that's kind of true, but not entirely. Like, these forces got interwebbed together. Like, you know, you had City Watch going all the way back to, like, probably Rome.
Yeah.
But having, like, local constabulary and stuff and peace officers, that's kind of a, you know, an early Imperial Britain thing.
Okay, well, listen, so we kind of talked about 1848. I want to have one more question about that. I want to move to the next date on our list, though. So because the main question is, when you're looking at riots and how they can turn into insurrections and then revolutions, would you agree that the primary thing you need to be looking at is, one, in order to figure out whether the piston box is going to work, mm-hmm. you have to know, one, is there a unity of class interest?
Right.
And two, is there enough political forces, whether they're multiple parties or one party or some mode of leadership, to give the spontaneous uprising a way to continue its expression? Is that, would you say that would be?
I would say that. And then if you look at the other thing you can take out of 1848 is that there is some, you have to deal with the fact that once that does happen, you still have to deal with a unity of political goals after a coalition forms. So you have, like, you definitely have immediate co-aligned class interests against the state, but what they want that state to do divides everything up almost immediately, to where the force of the Ancien Regime with some early bourgeois factors can put them down pretty quickly. And then those dissolve. I mean, you know, people couldn't read the Brumaire for the description of that in France, but like those dissolve almost immediately too. And so, because the reaction also isn't unified. And this leads to all kinds of weird things in Europe, but basically what the riots tell you in the beginning, in what they're interesting. So if you look at it, the reason why I mentioned 1830, if you look at that, there's hints that things are going wrong, but they stay very localized. Think like Ferguson. Like, Ferguson happens in Ferguson, and it spreads, but it doesn't, there's not any material reason for it to spread all over the United States all at once.
Yeah.
So
look, I want to talk about 1968 next rather than 1965.
So we're going to jump 120 years.
Yeah, 120 years into the future. Because I think that 1965 and 1992 kind of go together more than, and that 48 and 68 in the imagination kind of mm-hmm. go together, even though I don't think they do in fact, really. But, you know, if you want to look at to where the sources were, according to Daniel Singer in his book Prelude to Revolution, what were the sources of the uprisings and the general strike in 68? There are multiple strands of it. But if you're talking about just the rioting, the place to look would be Nanterre University. And the working class students at Nanterre, and then you have to look at their conditions. So at that point, the French state was beginning to try to compete more in the world market. The agricultural sector could still rely on price controls, but that led to uneven outcomes based on, you know, for small farmers as opposed to big agricultural industries. And so there was unrest or, you know, resentment there. But the main thing was that with a rising unemployment in that moment, although by Europeans, I mean, by French standards, it was a shock. But by European standards, British standards, and American standards, it was still a real low unemployment rate. It was 2.3%. But the rising unemployment rate, the change in the emphasis in production, the way that there was going to be a move away from the more rural forms of production and the more urbanization and modernization and entering into the world market, led to a feeling of dissatisfaction amongst the working class youth, and then also against sort of the lower tier of, let's call it the intelligentsia or the bureaucrats. The technology at the time, according to Daniel Singer, was leading to stratification within the managerial classes, and many people were put into positions that were so far away from any kind of real decision-making or power that they felt as if they might as well be just working class, actually, that they were just, you know, like the way I thought of it when I was reading this was like the Stanley parable, with Stanley just in a room pressing a button. He's not really working class because he's not producing anything, but he's just sort of a mechanism in the state apparatus. So all these things led to a feeling of dissatisfaction, especially amongst people who are in the midst of their training for this future. And that led to a dissatisfaction and then unrest at Nanterre around primarily at first the rules of cohabitation and in loco parentis. It was that they wanted to be able to visit the girls' dorms at night. That was one of the reasons they were out on the streets roaming around and protesting. But then it got to be a more general dissatisfaction and spread from Nanterre to the Sorbonne, and then the police violence against the students sparked unrest amongst the young workers, and the sympathies that everyone felt for the young workers and the students as they were beaten by the police led to a general strike, and millions of French people on strike for about a month in Paris. So that's just a sort of the broad outline there. But there were economic causes, and it was a change, I think, from a Fordist France into the gradual beginnings of a change into neoliberalism in 1968 that sparked was one of the reasons that that happened in May of 68.
So what do you see, like, how do you see 68 going differently than say 1965? Like, why does it go so differently in France, where they try to actually do, say, occupations of workplaces? There's a strike wave that goes with it very clearly, in a way that you don't see in the quote-unquote, I'm just using the term from what it was understood at the time, the ghetto riots in the 60s.
Well, okay. I think that the primary difference might be that that the way I would think of it is that there was a tradition in France of communism and radical politics that ran a little deeper than in the United States. So as early as 1966, the way that the student dissatisfaction was expressing itself was through a version of a Marxist kind of politics in a document like On the Poverty of Human Life. I'm sorry, Poverty of Student Life. The full name of the pamphlet that they printed and distributed 10,000 copies of at Nanterre was On the Poverty of Student Life, considered in its economic, political, psychological, sexual, and particularly intellectual aspects. It's not true, though, that there was no unrest in France along ethnic lines. It's just they were mostly Algerian.
Obviously, because you had the Algerian conflict in the backdrop of all this.
Yeah, and I mean, you had massacres in Paris.
Right. And
bodies of Algerian protesters dumped in the Seine. And that was, and I think that had something to do with the, the way the French students, young students, perceive their own relationship to the state as well, because the barbarism of the state was could be remembered inside, you know, the in their own country.
But did they see? I mean, one of the things I've always tried to understand is, because there was a whole lot of, you know, like we would say proto-third worldist or like Maoist agitation, and there's a whole lot of what you know other people call ultra-leftist agitation in France, you know, situationist.
The anti-Bolshevik tendencies that came out of socialism and barbarism, which was
right.
Julius Castriotis's publication.
So you have that sort of like Marxist humanist going into like ultra territory. You have there's just so much going on. I mean, originally
have to also put it all in the context of post-war France,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, and the because there was communist uprisings out of the resistance, the French resistance to Nazi occupation, mm-hmm. had communist elements to it that had to be put down after World War II, after they won back their liberty.
But 68 took a very strong stance against the formal Communist Party. I mean, that's one of the things about it. Like,
right. Yes.
Which you don't see prior. And I mean, there was a tendency, and I don't know if it was from Popular Front logic or monopoly capital logic or what, to be kind of talk out of both ends of your mouth in regards to this. I mean, like the formal party didn't oppose the 68 initially.
Well, yeah, the Communist Party, the formal Communist Party, and which was tied to the unions as well, in France, opposed the strikes and then came in to try to negotiate, you know, and turn them towards practical reforms. So the workers who are occupying the factories are never doing so at the request of their unions. And the primary, you know, unions at the time, you know, were counter-revolutionary. Mm-hmm. The question is, you know, I think from the looking back is, was the CGT and other communist officials at the time correct in thinking that there was no hope for a revolution at that moment, and that what they were looking at was adventurism and youthful exuberance that needed to be redirected into some sort of reformist moment or movement, or were they really a hindrance for something that could have exploded into revolution? And I think that the one thing you have to ask is, like, what is your model for revolution?
Well, I mean,
because I don't think there was any chance at that moment for there to be, even despite the way it may have looked, for there to be a real sustained revolutionary movement throughout all of Europe that would have started in France and spread to the rest of Europe. I've never heard anyone make a case for that being a possibility. And there wasn't any talk of that even amongst the students.
Right.
It was, you know, or the young workers. It was always just sort of the next step, whatever the next practical step could be. And the other thing is, when they did come together to try to figure out how they would go about forming a political power, they never did come to any kind of consensus around what they would do or who they would put forward or where or how they wanted to relate to the state.
Right.
There was a guy, Pierre Mendès France, who had been the president of the Council of Ministers, or roughly the prime minister for like 8 months in the 50s. And he'd been part of the Radical Party then, which was a far left party. And then he had moved to a little bit more moderate political party later. And he had been sort of in the background of the 68 protests, and he was a possible figure that they could have invested in. Maybe who was there, Bernie Sanders, you know, although that's an insult to him probably. But they never did coalesce around him. So there was no clear path towards state power, even in France for the 68.
One of the things that I have actually like looked at when I look at these history of revolutions, one of the things that kind of does concern me a little bit when we talk about them, and most Marxists kind of half don't really deal with the implications of it, is they take economic crisis in conjunctions with wars. Like if you look at the, and you know, I'm not going to talk about the character of the USSR right now or the Communist Party of China. But they both happen in the context of imperial breakdown leading in a war scenario paired with an economic crisis, paired with imperial interest in ways that you don't see in the attempts of it in the like in the West, which I don't like, you know, using that phrase exactly, but you don't see it in France. And so, like, the horizon of opportunities looks very different because the state is not that broken. It, but, you know, that's one of the things about these scenarios that's interesting is when is the state also weak and why? Like, 1848, there's famine, there's economic crisis, there's all these, you know, dispossessed because of proletarian bourgeoisification. In 68, you have the beginnings of, you know, the context is in like the, you know, the quote unquote third world revolutions, most of which, you know, are kind of half-assed by the imperial powers. And they put, you know, kind of they basically install whoever they think is going to kiss imperial ass the most. And then that goes poorly, as you would assume it would. And that's the context for this. Well, I mean, one of the things that you think about too is in the context of this in the United States when we get to 65, and we'll probably talk about that more in the second half with more free floating, is that that's in the context of all these things going on there, and actually for the United States, relative economic prosperity for everybody else, although it's beginning to slow. One of the things that I sent you about 65 is the impoverished.
Well, actually, about 67, what you sent me was
It was a commission studying in 67, studying the riots from like 64 to 67, right. And saying it had to do with black poverty in specific and that discrepancy between the two communities, as much as it did police violence. And LBJ didn't really like that. So, you know, but that context is always there. One of the things I was thinking about too, and it's hard to, you remember 92 better than me. I remember watching the LA riots on TV, but I was like 13. So, or 12 even.
I was 20, 21 in 92. Yeah, well,
92 was a recession, correct?
Yeah, but I mean, it was
one.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing about 92 for me was it was right after, I mean, it was coming right on the heels of the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, the Soviet Union had just fallen apart and we were in a recession. And
we had immediately had an invasion. We immediately had a big military action. And there was a lot of protests against Desert Storm. People forget this, but there was a major attempt to intervene and reject the invasion of Iraq the first time around after Saddam invaded Kuwait and we responded. The left was not quiet at that moment. There were, you know, the highways were blocked and it was a very popular war overall, but it was quickly sort of over, you know, by the time the 92 election came around, Bush was no longer popular. There was a bit of a recession going on. And that was all being sort of reevaluated as to how successful that had really been.
Right. Well, one of the things I was thinking about, the LA riots ended up not being that big of a threat to the police or to the state ultimately, even though it seemed like it.
Main thing that happened out of that, now when I look back on it, was that it helped get rid of the Bush administration.
Right.
one.
You know, and I think one of the things I was thinking about, like, why was the Bush administration willing to use the Insurrection Acts one of the few times it's been used? It was used all the time in, you know, the post-Civil War, you know, conditions in the United States. But it hadn't really been used in the 20th century. And why were they willing to do it? And I was thinking about, like, there's this context of social degeneration in the USSR that we just lived through. Like, it seemed monumentous. And yet, when I went to do readings on the LA riots versus 68 or 1848, I actually couldn't find that much, like, trying to link the end of the Soviet Union. Or even when I was doing it, I didn't find that much discussion of the Gulf War, which I was surprised, because I'm like, well, I know the, you know, brief fatality is related to that, but the social conditions are all tied up in these.
But, you know, my perspective on this was very much a Portlander who had just come out of, like, you know, I worked at the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group and was against the war and was feeling like, you know, the whole world that I had just entered adulthood into was corrupt and that capitalism had to go, although I didn't know what that meant and all that kind of thing. So I was putting things together in a way that maybe not everyone was. And also, you know, the thing about the LA riots that people really noticed was that it was captured on videotape.
Right.
You know, and that it could get passed around outside of the mainstream media. So that this had been somebody's personal camcorder that they had and just had happened to capture the beatings of Rodney King, who, by the way, didn't die. I mean, he wasn't even killed. He was just beaten very, very severely in a way that made no sense.
On PCP, and he clearly wasn't. Yeah.
Right. I
remember. But, I mean,
during the riots, he himself went on television and said, hey, stop, can't we all get along? And
stuff. Yeah, I remember. I remember it was kind of a joke when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I remember about that, I remember also the ghost of those riots being involved in people's fears about, you know, the O.J. Simpson trial leading to riots. Another thing I remember is you did have like this kind of black cultural renaissance very briefly, like in 90, like look at the movies next year. I mean, you have like a whole lot of movies about, you know, LA and the city culture come out.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a cultural effect.
The main thing it did is give Bill Clinton made Bill Clinton. Remember, he's the first black president.
Yeah. That's so weird to think about, but yeah, I mean that, so you had you had society moving, but the political order weirdly didn't move that much. And
it deepened in the direction of neoliberalism.
Right.
It took what Reagan and Bush had been doing and doubled down and tripled down on it.
Well, one of the things that you have brought out to me is like welfare reform was actually peddled by Clinton as an answer to the LA riots, which is crazy. And I had no idea. Like, I knew that was part of like Clinton's continued support of the kind of beef up of the police that had started in the 80s. But I didn't know that was also used as a justification for welfare.
We had to get rid of the culture of poverty that was weighing down black America.
So we did that by neoliberalizing. So we had got rid of the culture of poverty.
But black capitalism, baby, that was, that was a solution.
I mean, you saw similar, like, when I sent you that commission article, what was that commission called?
The one on 64 to 67.
Yeah, the one was done in 67.
On Smithsonian Magazine.
Yeah, I sent you an article about it, and like LBJ kind of set on the results because the moderates were like, "It's black poverty, stupid." Like, it's the economy, stupid. Like, but one of the interesting things about that is like, that's the same logic that Clinton uses, but he flips the like what he's calling for. You have so instead of like, you know, a more equitable, you know, welfare state, you get like, well, we'll just make everyone go back to work and
we'll get rid of the culture of dependency and create incentives for entrepreneurship within the inner city.
Right. One of the interesting things I was also surprised at when I was reading about the communists, for example, do you know what actually prompted the Trafalgar Square riots. I didn't go into it. It was a proposal for an existence of an income tax.
Oh. Wow.
The communists were opposed to an income. I mean, of course they would be, right? It increases the power of the state. They were afraid that it was going to be applied to not just the bourgeoisie, but to the working people who already didn't have, like, they already paid other taxes. Mm. But it was an opposition to an income tax.
Well, we've been talking for 50 minutes. What I'm realizing is we could go on and on and talk for another 50 minutes before we covered all this territory, even remotely adequately. But I guess I want to ask, like, okay, when we talked about 68, we've talked about 48, we've touched on 92.
Mm-hmm. We touched very briefly on 65, but indirectly.
Yeah, indirectly. We need to talk about 65 in the next hour. But I guess what I want to ask is, you know, look, I think it's, to me, it's clear that this moment we're in now is not 92, and it is not 65.
And it is not 68.
And it's not even 68, right? It's closer to 1848 than it is to those other things. And the first thing that I said when I saw this happen was, hey, you know, this isn't the revolution. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. And I think that that's still true, but I was vastly underestimating the way these different factors would come together. Because I think that what we have to look at now is not just racial disparity in outcomes with the police, not just racial disparity when it comes to incarceration or income inequality or wealth inequality, which are all very, you know, real and have a big impact on the way that Black people feel about this country and how they receive problems, but also the pandemic, the economic crisis of this moment, the massive unemployment rate, even though it's not as bad as maybe it was expected in May, it's still off the chart.
Yeah, today you're hearing financial reporting, a fear of a banking collapse a la 2008 again, and because of a different set of collateralized loans involving housing defaults, because the housing market problems have been just delayed. They haven't actually been dealt with. We don't know what's going to happen there yet. And if they all pop at once, you actually have a similar organ. I think it's called a CDL, which is very similar to a collateralized debt option. And some of the banks are heavily leveraged with them and some of them aren't. So if you have a housing crisis that precipitate from this, which we haven't seen yet because they've just been stalled, you could have another problem. And today also, even though like there's been all this disconnect, today we had a run on the stocks because of fear of a second round of coronavirus, as if that wasn't obvious going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of conditions right now that are 1848-esque, and I think we can get very caught up in like very specific things like this autonomous zone in Seattle and not do analysis on what's going on and where it's happening at and why. Like where is this happening? One of the things about, if you know, to tie it in a little bit, the current events, and I don't want to get too into that, but one of the things about Minneapolis and St. Paul is those cities are poor. Mm-hmm. And then, so you see actions in like the poor cities in the United States, as opposed to actions in the Bay, LA, Seattle, New York, which are objectively pretty rich comparatively. I mean, like, yes, there are poor people in those places. There's tons. And in fact, in some ways, there's more disparity in those places than other places.
Yeah, there's more inequality, which makes them more perhaps crime-ridden
but volatile. Like,
volatile, yeah.
Crime's been down everywhere.
Isn't inequality one of the, you know, noticeable inequality, one of the things that's sort of a predictor for an increase in crime?
Yeah, it's also a predictor for just increase in general social unrest. So crime's part of that, but also so are riots. If there were striking organs that go into it, another thing we have to consider right now that is different from 68, who's in the unions? We have like only 70% of the workforce is in unions. Most of those are public sector workers. And I was looking at it and I couldn't tell if like half of those publics or more than half of those public sector workers are NEA and FOP.
I think that the place will explain what that one would mean.
Well, it means that it's half teachers and half cops. And like you have like highly unionized, like city drivers and stuff are things in New York, LA, actually in Minneapolis. You still have like pretty strong unions in that, you know, former sewer socialist area, as opposed to like the South and a lot of the rest of the Sun Belt. Mm-hmm. But if you still looked at like who's in the unions, they're mostly municipal workers. And the largest two employment sectors for municipal workers that I know of is education and cops.
Yeah, right. Well, there, I think that I heard that there was going to be someone messaged me and said that their union was splitting off from the cop union.
Yeah, there have been individual unions who are refusing to cooperate. The NEA has actually not been, like, on the ground, I've heard it's not been super cooperative with the cops either. I know I'm in it here. We've heard nothing. Like, we haven't brought it up at all.
But here, I think the non-union workers are where it's going to be at, if it's going to be anywhere. I don't think, right. I think it's going to be people like Chris Smalls. I don't think it's going to be big union organizers that are consequential. But that's just my bias.
No, I think you're right, because those also, if you look at the proletariat, the, you know, people who work in servicing commodity flows, they are largely non-unionized, not totally. And we've seen some growth, but you're talking a growth between 16% and 17%. And with the great majority of those unions still being public sector employees. And you've had cooperation. Like when we did this 2 weeks ago, someone asked me if I'd heard if there were unions involved in this. And I said no. And then the next day, there was all kinds of stuff about, like, you know, local unions in Minneapolis not working with the, you know, even despite the AFL-CIO's, like, strategically keeping his mouth shut, you know, not being willing to work with the cops, not being willing to stand with the FOP, you know, kind of putting the FOP to kind of.
I tell you something. If you want to, for me, the more radical move is not to defund the cops, but to kick them out of your union. Don't work with the cop unions. I think that will help the working class just as much as defunding.
One of the major union organizations is moving to do that, but I can tell you why the AFL-CIO isn't, because if they do that, I think they lose. I don't know, but I think you're going to lose a large chunk of the unionized workforce, you know, on paper.
Yeah, and a lot of their union dues will go missing.
Right.
A lot of their money. So let's take a couple questions from chat now. Yeah. We got one here. What does it mean to be closer to 1848? Is it the severity or magnitude of militancy and rioting? Well, it's that. Magnitude of militancy, but it's the pervasiveness. It's the way it spread and as quickly as it did, and the reaction from the state, which I felt viscerally right away, which was that, you know, this was not being perceived as an annoyance or a crime problem, but it was being perceived as a threat to the state. And I don't think it was just Trump.
No, thought of it. Although it does seem like that narrative has quickly changed, Doug. I mean, would you say like the liberal endorsement and co-option of this has been?
Oh, it's been tremendously effective.
Yeah, and rapid. Like,
no, I know, when I saw that Trump, the way he announced he was going to use the military. And he said he was going to do it in defiance of the governors.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of breathed a sigh of relief in a way, not completely, but I started to feel a little bit better. And then the next day when it didn't really happen and everyone was outraged and it became a political football and all of that, I felt a lot better. And I do think that, you can, you know, the Democratic Party has been very, very good at coming in and de-escalating,
the very situation that the mayors have set up.
Say that again?
I was like, it's de-escalated the very situation most of its mayors have helped set up.
Right.
I mean, like, if you look at the apparatus of the cities where this is the biggest, they're all Democratic cities. And I'm not saying that because most cities are Democratic, right? That's the demographic of Democrats, like even in red states.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, like Salt Lake City in the heart of bright red Utah is a Democratic stronghold.
But we were asked the question, like, what was made this closer to 1848? And I would say that it's the fact that I don't see anything coming, and I could be wrong. I could be totally wrong, but I don't see anything coming that's going to relieve the tensions and the immiseration of the working class. And we just had a moment which was almost taken in as a moment of working class power.
Yeah.
And a weakness of the state. But anyway, going back to the thing about the democratic cities and the de-escalation.
Well, another thing about makes it similar to 1848 is that it's not just in one country, really. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not talking about these protests, but there are other.
I refuse to be that fucking optimistic, Derek. I refuse to accept that what's happening in Europe is in any way really like what's happening here. But if it is.
I don't think it is. I think what's happening in Russia is closer. Mm-hmm. And what's happening in Russia is not being covered by the Western press that much. I don't know why. Because you have this highly federated system where like the federal, like outside of Moscow, like they're just gobbling up resources right now. And so there was movement against that, and it was, you know, it wasn't like the haircut petite bourgeois people that we were dealing with here, because the lockdowns weren't coming with any assistance from the state that was getting to most people in these areas. It's hard to say.
So Android Politician says 68 did not have like a 20% unemployment rate.
No, it didn't.
It didn't. It had a 2.3 unemployment rate, but according to Daniel Singer, that was still a shock to the working class in France at the time. And it was a symptom of the changing situation away from, let's call it Fordism, towards neoliberalism in 68. Although, you know, they weren't using those terms at the time.
Right. Fordism and like proto Keynesianism kind of, but more Fordism in the case of France, right? Like it was, but you had damn near full employment for a long time.
You did. That's right. You had really close to full employment in France, and for it to slip down to 2.3% unemployment, along with a feeling of insecurity and a lack of participation and significance in the economy, I think that was a big part of it. And you know, basically, the other thing was you were suddenly shifting because you had this 2.3 unemployment, mm-hmm. and you had to shift some of the working class into the university sector just to hold them in order to keep that unemployment rate.
You've had that in the Western world for 40 years is the increasing like this drift. And I don't even think it's planned. It was planned at first, but this drift towards credentialization to sort out applicants as population sizes get much. It also regulates the amount of people can enter the workshops at one time. And you've seen that like in education right now, where everybody kind of wants schools to open back up because they want people to be able to go back, but they have no idea how to do it with social. I mean, like it's going to be a mess.
Yeah. The other thing about the Nanterre was that was an American style university. It was an import from the state. So it was like, you know, you didn't necessarily live on campus or you know, it wasn't integrated. It was out in the suburbs. It wasn't integrated into the city. It was just a completely different kind of model of education there. I don't even know. I don't remember all the details, but yeah, I do think that, you know, I think when there are major changes to the capitalist order, when contradictions come up and there are major changes to the capitalist order, there are potentials for things for a more radical change. But I think we're in a moment which has that potential now. And in the second half, we'll talk about how completely fucking unprepared and what a fucking mess the left is. And we'll save that for our patrons who get to hear me be much grouchier. What about 1917? Didn't Derek say there were riots leading into the October Revolution?
There were bread riots. The difference is one of the differences is you had these underground political movements that have been developing for 20 years by the time those things happened, and they were ready to go. And they were also able to play, you know, other imperial powers against Russia to get them back into the country so that they could take advantage of that. That, you know, like The number of conflating factors that seem to make a successful a riot turn into a sexual revolution is pretty much like really hard to predict. But yeah, the February Revolution was totally started by bread riots. And the October Revolution was pushed by the fact that things weren't getting better after, you know, the liberal provisional government took power. So, because they weren't in war.
I want to, at this moment, as we near the point where we're going to close out this first half, I just want to say to anyone who's wanting to and feels like they can, you know, we certainly do appreciate it when you use the super chat. That's what makes these live streams kind of go, is the fact that people do throw in a couple bucks here and there with the super chat. They get fewer views on the channel, but I feel like, you know, they justify themselves financially anyway through that. Although the other thing is, you can also support us on Patreon if you want to listen to the second hour. And I am now feeling like a complete whore. So let's move on. And you don't have to use the super chat or go to Patreon to have your questions answered here in the live stream, though. So someone asked the question, I'm a patron, but I don't know how to watch the patron stream. Help anyone? Well, two things. One is you go to the Patreon page, and I put a link to the unlisted YouTube video there, and it's, you can watch it on the Patreon page or go to the YouTube to watch the unlisted video from there. The other thing is you can listen to it as a podcast if you're subscribed as a patron to our patron only podcast feed. If you are having trouble with that, reach out to me through the Patreon page or through Facebook. I'm Doug Lane in Portland, Oregon, Douglas Lane in Portland, Oregon. And I'll try to help you out finding the RSS feed for the Patreon podcast. But those are the ways to get access to the Patreon only video feed. Okay. You're smirking at me, Derek. Anyways, just watching.
No, it's just we have to do business sometimes.
Being a, let's talk about the revolution is coming. But don't forget, Super Chat and Patreon.
The living contradictions of our world sometimes are pretty amusing. Any other questions from the peanut gallery?
Someone says, don't feel guilty, Doug. Okay, well, thank you for that. I'm not seeing questions. Oh, well, here's one. Can you compare the process living in America with the Gezi resistance that happened in Turkey in 2013?
You know, I wish I could. I was actually in Turkey not long after that, but it was... that felt very similar to Occupy from what talking to people in Istanbul in 2015, but they didn't go into details, and I would be very remiss to say that it is actually kind of similar. One thing I can say though is the opposition to Erdogan wasn't so much secular versus Islamist as much as it was Istanbul versus almost everywhere else. And like I was even talking to like, you know, atheists and Selçuk, and they all kind of supported Erdogan, which surprised me. So you know, it's hard for me to say exactly how that compares to now. It did very much from the description of English speaking Turks. So there's a lot of mediation there. Sound a little bit like, you know, an Occupy to a, you know, to a strongman style. Well, you know, not Erdogan's complicated, but strongman style.
I want to point out that the Duck King says that I need to feel 100% guilty, 100%. I don't have enough guilt in my life. And I just want to say that is my son, Noah.
Oh, okay.
That's his self portrait there.
Yeah, quick, Noah. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're grounded.
Being grounded in coronavirus is almost.
Yeah, I don't even know what that means, but it's happening. So does this riot create the possibility of anti-work struggles? I don't think there's much of a possibility of anti-work struggles right now.
Yeah, it doesn't usually happen in up economies, man. Like you have
everyone struggling to get work, and I think what we have to demand, despite the fact that I like Bob Black and. I know that ultimately the aim of the revolution would be to overcome class division, meaning we'd overcome the way we understand work and there wouldn't be a working class. Nonetheless, full employment, I think, is a radical demand. that we need at this moment. And that makes me, maybe I'm moving further and further to the right with every passing year, but I think that's
more
right.
And more like a social democrat, like half this channel.
so, I mean, I don't think that that's a, I think that that's a radical demand. I don't think that's like a radical.
Well, I think reform. It's a radical demand because it's impossible.
I don't know. I mean, in the context of a moment where trillions are being thrown out the door to just keep the corporations afloat, and the need to really offer support to the general population in order to hold back a massive pandemic, the demand for full employment doesn't seem as irrational as it might, or as impossible. I mean, different context.
I don't even disagree with you, actually. One of the things I've been shocked at these days is, like, you know, CNBC guys like Fraser and stuff, Mad Money people saying, like, we just saw the biggest wealth transfer upwards that we've ever seen in the history of the United States, and, like, barely anyone commented. And, you know, that's depends on where the tax burden ultimately goes, but he's not wrong. If it's paid for by taxes and not by magical MMT magic, then what, you know, that will be a burden on, I mean, basically we are collectivizing the burden of keeping capital and currency, you know, supported.
Well, the whole thing is based on the idea that there will be enough economic growth that the taxation in the future will not be a massive burden. Right. I mean, that's, you know, that's the idea.
That's a big leap of faith, man.
Like, bullshit is what it is. But
I mean, like, how much economic, like, even right now, China's in a recession. China.
I know.
I mean, like, it's
most of the developing world is going to hit a recession. For the, according to Michael Roberts, it's like, for the first time in 60 years, the developing world is going to start to stall out rather than slowly move forward.
Yeah, that's really disheartening.
It is. Yeah. Someone says, isn't this just Occupy 2.0 on the left activist side combined with already liberal co-opted riots? See the autonomous zones. Yeah.
It's hard. I say it's hard to say. There's, like, I would definitely say there's Occupy 2.0 elements in this. There's also, you know, BLM 2.0 elements. There's real attempts to do, like, mutual aid and stuff that are pretty massive.
You can't look at Occupy or BLM and see just one thing, right?
Right.
The Occupy movement had lots of elements to it. The leadership of the Occupy movement, for the most part, didn't have a very solid or developed or useful political vision. They were more conservative than the moment they were in or the movement they were in. Same thing is certainly true with BLM. But with the autonomous zone, when I first heard about it, I was optimistic, not because I'm just in love with the kinds of people who talk about autonomous zones generally, but because I thought, well, look, there was almost an insurrection. It needed to move into the realm of the political, and taking property, taking hold of some space and using it to bring people together to talk politically had to happen if this was going to go anywhere other than just to mass arrests or violent conflict, or into marching around into nothing. So I saw this as a positive step at first, but then the impossibility of having any useful political conversation that wasn't dominated by the already existing social democratic left in Seattle, which may not even be that bad a thing for it to be dominated by that, but I'm just saying that the conflict between them and the anarchist sect made everything seem very ugly. And then you throw in what I think of as kind of the backwards racial politics in the left, you know, you got a real clusterfuck in the autonomous zone. But I still, nonetheless, am critically supporting it for now.
I am trying to figure out who's actually in that autonomous zone, given that the demographic of the capital in Seattle is 80% white and over 100K median income. I don't think those are the people there. But the fact that the police just left, they didn't And apparently, like, I've heard people in Seattle say they've, like, police have been allowed to tour the grounds. And that's part of why some of those, like, don't let politicians and police back in demands kind of came up. But it feels to me a little bit like Arab Springy, where, like, you have the people, like, giving you what you're asking for, but they're also probably putting a poison pill in it somewhere. Like, like that's what I, and I'm going to be interested as I think there's a workers collective in Philly trying to do something. And I want to see how it's going to play out in a different racial demographic city than Seattle. And where it might be viewed by the state as more, if it's as big, more actually dangerous, because I have been sort of like, is the Seattle government just thinking that it's going to peter out on its own, like Occupy kind of did in Zuccotti Park, and then they're not going to have to do anything? Because, you know, if they break up a violence, it could spark everything off everywhere. So just let it kind of peter. Like, I'm trying to think, like,
well, I think that's probably right. I mean, I don't think that's bad strategy either for them. I think that's probably right. Because I don't think anyone wants to continue really violent interactions between the cops and the National Guard and street protesters now. I think that everyone wants to see everyone.
I think Trump liked threatening it, but I don't think he wants to deliver on it.
No. Do you know what it would do the American economy to send the military into our cities?
Our dollar would tank. The dollar as international reserve currency.
I think so. That's what it seemed like to me. I think our standing and the idea that we were a stable investment resource, you know, that we were really a stable source of power in the world, would just be shot in a way that we can barely imagine.
There's some short selling of the dollar now, but it's still actually relatively strong compared to other currencies. So it's hard to know, you know, where all these plays in, but I promise you someone's thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, listen, we've done this for an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and 16 minutes. With this kind of moment in time, we could keep going forever. Why don't we take a break, come back for the patron, only stream, maybe do 45 minutes on that and then call it a night. What do you say?
All right. I'm up for that. Good night. Good luck. Don't get tear gas. And if you clear it off tear gas, remember it's a powder. Just wash it off with water. Don't do anything else.
No milk. And also, please do not don't cancel me on Twitter. Please.
You're going to get canceled. This is pop. Yeah. This is pop.